You have to act on what you think about. You can't act on anything else. The ancestor to every action is a thought. So if your mind is on what you don't like, then what you don't like has to expand for you. Now know this, if you know nothing else, that every single problem that you have in your life, every problem that you have, you experience in your mind. You experience it in thought. In thought. It's how you process things. It's what you do with it in your thoughts that makes it a problem. Otherwise, if you're in a coma, you wouldn't be experiencing it. It's your mind. So if you know that the problems that you have in your life are in your mind, then you must know that the solution to those problems also has to be in your mind. It can't be in something or someone changing in order for you to get better or happier. If you think that someone else makes you miserable, you get those people and send them to me. And I will treat them, and then you will get better. And that's absurd. Of course we know that. So that the solution as well as the problem is within. I spent 2 years writing a book called What Do You Really Want for Your Children? What do you really want for your children? If you want for them what I think we want for our children, that is to be self-reliant, that is to have a sense of mission and purpose in life, that is to be creative, that is to be happy, fulfilled, blame-free people who take responsibility for their lives, rather than people who wear the right clothes and have the right labels and do all of these things, then what you really want for your children is something based on strength. And you can't build anything when you start with weakness. So that if what you're doing with your kids is always seeing them doing things wrong, and that's your problem, that's what's difficult for you, is you see them doing things wrong all the time, then how do you change that? You change it by looking for the things that they do right, by catching them doing things right, by focusing on their greatness, their grandness, their divineness, their beauty, and reinforcing that, giving away what's inside. And the more you catch them doing things right, the more you find them doing things right. And the more you catch them doing things wrong, the more you find them doing things wrong. And it's all your experience. It's the same thing is true of all your physical maladies. If you've got a sniffle in your nose, and you say, it's Monday morning, it's in my nose, but tomorrow it'll be in my throat. I know it. There's your mind. Those are your thoughts. That's 99% of who you are. And you say, well, on Wednesday it'll be in my chest. On Thursday I'm going to have a fever. I'm going to have to take Friday off. And it's still Monday morning. Monday morning, you got a sniffle, and all of a sudden it's Friday with a fever. You become what you think about all day long. That was Earl Nightingale, the recipient of this honor 2 years ago before his death. Man who I was honored to write the introduction to his book, The Strangest Secret. You become what you think about as you think. So shall you be. And that is true for virtually everything in your life. So that people who are looking at their partner and looking at what makes them miserable, it's not surprising that misery expands for them. You become what you think about all day long. What you think about is what expands.
Human beings are multidimensional. We don't get that. We think we're just one-dimensional. Maybe two we'll get in. We don't see that there's 18, 20, 50, hundreds of dimensions that are all part of this transitional process called humanity. And that when you get this inside of you, that death is no longer anything to be terrified of. It's just you understand, you know, it isn't a belief, it isn't a faith, it isn't a religious thing. It's an understanding that you can't kill thought. And form never dies. It is always just in transition. And if you just ask yourself the question, am I a body with a soul, or am I a soul with a body? And if you know that you're a soul with a body, if you know that you aren't this body, and that you've been in many bodies already. You've been in this little body, and then in this 12-year-old body, and this 18-year-old body. You've been in all these bodies. When there's no form left to any of them, you take on a whole new approach to this terrifying thing called aging or dying. I had to address the Florida Council on the Aging last week. I was the keynote speaker. And I got up there and I said, and there were all of these people who work with aging people and all of these older people and so on. And I got up and my opening line was, "You've asked me to be the keynote speaker on a subject that I don't believe in. I don't believe in aging. You can't age thought. You can't age spirit. You can't age divinity. You can't age feeling. You can only age form. And I know that's not just me. And that's what this whole thing is about. That's really what we're talking about. Understanding that who you are, because you can't touch, feel, grab, and do all that stuff you can do with that pile of bones and gristle and veins and things like that. And because you can't get a hold of all of that, doesn't mean that it doesn't exist any more than the wind doesn't exist because you can't get a handful of it. No one has ever seen the wind. You can't see wind. You can't hold wind. You can't smell wind. You can't touch wind. You can only see the results of wind. That's all. You know that wind exists, but nobody's ever seen wind. How can you do that? So it exists independent of whether you can touch it or grab it or not. And as you get into this awakening process, this highest level, that frees you from all of the stuff that immobilizes most people, all of the anguish, all the depression, all of the having to get ahead, all of the accumulation anxieties, all the type A behavior and the hurry sickness that we suffer from. That stuff becomes something in the past that is just thought. It's just there. And you'll never, ever be knocked around by it again. So thought is an endless energy that goes on and on. And if you know that that's who you are, this ability to think. And for the skeptics, I would suggest to you that what you do is you think about everything that's ever happened to you up until this moment and understand that all of it up until right now in this moment that you are alive is in the realm of thought. You can't touch any of it. You can't have any of it. And yet it's very real for you. You can get very emotional about it. You can have experiences through that thought, but you can't ever have it. You can't ever touch it in the form sense. So that your whole experience of your past up until this very second is all in thought and nothing more. Right? And yet it's very real. And then I would say to you that to think about everything that's going to happen to you from this second on and to understand that that's also nothing more than pure thought. You can't have any of that. You can't touch tomorrow. You can't get a hold of your goals. You can't have those and dissect them and treasure them. You can't take tomorrow's BMW and drive it. That's all just thought. And yet you can also have the experience within your form, within yourself, through thought. So your whole past and your whole future are a thought. So that only leaves you with now. Then what you do is you look at now and you look at all the things that are important to you that you want for yourself. And you start with your children and your wife or your husband and your co-workers and your parents and all of these people. And you understand that the only way you can ever experience them in the moment is through thought. Through your mind. You can't do it any other way. You can't get behind their eyeballs and be them. That's the limitation of form. So you can only do that through thought. And then you take all of the stuff that you want to accumulate and you begin to see that that's only thought too. That's only thought. You can't be a diamond. You can't be a new house. You can't even have it. You can't even own it. It is only in your mind that you do something with it and you can experience it, but you can't have it.
How many of you get tired? You don't have to get tired. I don't get tired.
When it's time to go to sleep, there's no insomnia in my life, and there doesn't have to. Insomnia is one more of those things where you start telling yourself, I'm not going to be able to sleep. Look, you've been out, you're partying, you're at a convention, you're in New Orleans. Get into bed, let's say, and it's 2 o'clock, and you know you got to get up at 6. You look at your watch. All right, it's 2 o'clock. 3 o'clock. 4 o'clock. 5 o'clock. 6. 1, 2, 3. If I were to fall asleep right this second, and I'm not even close, all right, I'd only get 4 hours of sleep. Here it comes, ready? Great imagery now. Boy, am I going to be tired tomorrow. Whew! Oh, I'm going to be tired. That'll keep you awake for at least an hour, all right? Your body just kind of goes, oh, my God, and you start interfering with it. Your mind starts programming you, all right? Now, an hour later, you look at your watch and say, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock. 3 hours. Now you upgrade your neurotic expectations for yourself. I'm going to be a zombie tomorrow. And then when you get out of bed and the alarm goes off, if you sleep, what do? You start counting backwards now. 5 o'clock, 4 o'clock.
You put your body instantly on droop. Kind of put your eyes sort of on bag. Don't expect anything out of me today. I didn't get any sleep last night or whatever. Until someone comes along halfway through the day and says, you know, we got a game tonight and we're going to go out and have a few drinks and we're going to, hey, that's great. Yeah, I think I'd like to do that. It's a choice.
You ever notice how tired you get when you got something unpleasant to do? You know, you look at the lawn equipment and look at the roller and the edger. I'm going to lie down for 3 or 4 months. I'm really tired. It's a choice. If you just tell yourself, I don't need to think tired thoughts.
Every single one of us know that we can't get tired when we've got something important to do, but how easy it is to get tired when we've got something unpleasant to do, you know. Come on, honey, I want you to cut the grass, and I want you to edge it. Oh, God, how I hate edging. And I want you to, you know, roll it, and I want you to get all the fertilizer out there and do all of those kind of things. Oh, God, am I tired. I think I'll lie down for 3 months, 4 months, whatever, you know. On the other hand, it's like, honey, would you like to go to this party tonight? Everybody's going, yeah, all of a sudden you're not tired anymore. When there's something that you really are interested in doing, suddenly the fatigue factor, when you got to sit down and do your homework, and you hate your homework. You hate algebra, X's and Y's and Z's and all of those things, or geography or learning capitals and all of that. So you sit down and, boy, do you get tired fast. I think I can't stay awake. I do this. You know? And then all of a sudden, a phone call from a friend. Oh, yeah, and 2 hours on the telephone with all of the energy in the world. It's a choice. It's something that we have within us, the capacity to have or not to have. And you know something? I carry it, I think, sometimes to maybe ridiculous extremes, but I believe it. The only clients in therapy that I've taken in the last 2 or 3 years are some women who have been diagnosed as terminal in cancer and have been told that they only have a short amount of time to live or that their disease is going to immobilize them permanently and so on. And it's almost a personal mission challenge for me because I believe that somewhere within every one of us, we can, if we know how to let it out, muster up the strength, the will, the power, the tremendous energy to lick anything. And it comes from that personal energy within us. And that kind of a challenge. And I've seen it happen. In fact, there's a book out right now, Anatomy of an Illness by Norman Cousins, where he talks about having been told that he had a disease of the spine, the degenerative tissue of the spine, and that he had a 1 chance in 500 or something of even surviving it, let alone ever walking again. And he decided within him that he absolutely was not going to give into it. He was going to keep himself as up and creative and excited, and in fact, he used laughter, which I've always really, I don't think we've researched enough the importance of laughter and how good it feels to laugh and how therapeutic it is to be able to laugh at ourselves and others and not to take life so seriously, not to have that stony kind of grimness about ourselves. And what he did is he sent in for all of the things that he ever thought were funny in his life into his hospital bedroom. He had Marx Brothers films sent in, he had Abbott and Costello films sent in, and he played them over and over again and had this raucous kind of gut laughter day after day after day. Now, that plus combined with attitude and belief and all kinds of other things, something that every doctor, I'm sure there are many here in the audience, knows, every surgeon particularly knows, that anybody who is going into surgery, and it is serious surgery, knows that if they have a patient who has a will to live and survive, and has a patient who has given up and feels down and depressed, that the person who has the will to live and to pull themselves through this thing has such a greater chance of making it than the person who's already given up. Now, we can't define what that will to live is. We can't put a statistical mark on it, but we know it's there. In emergencies, in pulling your own strings, if you've read that, you saw a case of, out of thousands of these, where a woman was... A 95-pound woman was driving across Texas with her son, and they got a flat tire, and he got out, and he jacked up the car, and he got under there to put the tire out, and the car collapsed on his chest, and he was laying there, breathing his last breath, turning blue, gasping and saying, I'm going to die, I can't. And this 95-pound woman picked up a 1957 DeSoto. Do you remember those? And lifted it long enough for him to crawl out and dropped it. The thing weighed 5,000 pounds. Somehow, within her, there was some strength there that said, you can't get a jack. You can't go for a phone call. There's, you know, this isn't the way to handle this thing. And she just did the only thing that she... Within each one of us is that kind of capacity, and we haven't even begun to tap it. We haven't particularly begun to tap it in the physical realm. I mean, you can make a commitment in your life to something as basic and simple as whether or not you're going to be sick anymore. Or the extent to which you are going to allow some illnesses which you have no control over, which are there, some infirmities, the extent to which you are going to permit them to immobilize you, to keep you down. You can decide that. I have, in my own life, made some decisions about my own health, and I've carried them out up to this day. And some of those decisions involve whether or not I'm going to have colds and backaches and flu and things like that, which I don't think about. You want to know something? I honestly don't think I know how to be sick anymore. And I say that in front of all of these witnesses without any fear that something is going to get a hold of me and so on. It's like I look at that as a challenge. I used to get colds about every... 3 months or so, because I watch television, and television tells you when to get a cold. Because they want to sell you Dristan or whatever it is that they're selling. Cold season's here, parents. Cold season's here. Don't sleep in a draft. You sleep in a draft, you're going to catch a cold. Better put some shoes on. If you get, you're going to catch a cold. Whatever. And, I mean, I don't think of myself as any... person who has any special gifts other than just inside a determination that I don't want to spend the days of my life being sick. So my way of fighting it, first of all, is to keep myself in shape by running and being physically active, which are a very, very important part of my life, and I believe in it strongly for myself and for those who want to make that choice, and by just simply watching some of the kinds of foods that you eat, and not thinking sick and keeping yourself in a top physical shape. Because I really believe this. If you don't take time in your life for exercise and health, then you have to take time later for illness and being immobilized. The choice is yours. You will have to take the time later if you don't take the time now. And how can there be any greater priority in your life than that body you carry around with you everywhere you go, keeping it in the top kind of physical shape you can. Now, one of my arguments with the way medicine and psychology are practiced in the world today can be seen if I just give you a little illustration. Let's say that this is point A right here, okay? And this right here is point B, and this right here is point C. All right? And this is a continuum. This is your life. This is in illness. This is point A represents an absence of health, what we call death, or really immobilized sickness, okay? And we move up this way towards about here, which is point B, which is no symptoms. Nothing's wrong with us, all right? We're just feeling normal. Okay, and then between B and C over here, C at the end of this continuum represents complete possibilities, total potential for health. Okay? In other words, this is as healthy as you can get. This is an absence of symptoms, and this is all symptoms, all right? Real illness. Almost all medicine in this country is practiced between A and B. You don't go to the doctor unless you've got something wrong with you. When you've got something wrong with you, you go and you tell them about your symptoms. I've got sniffles, I've got a fever, my arm hurts, whatever it may be. And you go, and this is the way medicine is practiced, between here and trying to get you to here so that you don't have any more symptoms, right? There's another place to practice medicine, and that is between B and C, where I think all medicine should be practiced. Not all, but most of it. Certainly if you have a gallbladder that needs to be taken out, that's back here and you have it taken out. But between B, that is feeling normal, and C, that your maximum potential for health, what a fantastic way to practice medicine. Preventive medicine, if you will, holistic medicine, humanistic medicine, behavioral medicine. It's starting to gather momentum across the country. But imagine you go, you use a physician or you use the field of medicine in terms of getting healthier instead of getting rid of sickness. How healthy can you be? Ever think about that? How possibly healthy can you be? How many vitamins can you get in you? How many of you can run 50 miles without being tired? Can you exercise all day and love it? Can you feel great? Can you walk up 20 flights of stairs and not even be breathing hard? Can you go for a hike in the woods and not even have it affect you? All of the things that are possible for you as a human being, what a wonderful way to practice medicine. A medicine of being, of holistic, humanistic approach to treating people. What a wonderful idea. It's what No Limit people do all the time. They're always thinking of how healthy they can be. They don't see a symptom as a reason to go off to the physician, pop some pills, consume some Valium, some Librium, put those aspirin into you every time you have a little headache, go off and have somebody else tell you what's wrong with you by pouring more and more drugs into you. But instead, and I am not here to put down modern medicine. I know that life expectancies have increased. I respect doctors as much as any professional there is out there. They are, without a doubt, our best trained professionals, bar none, in all of the things that we do. I respect it immensely. But I think the possibilities for treating people physically and training ourselves from young people to grow up to think healthy, potentially as healthy as we can be, imagine raising your child to think that way. So that if you didn't complain about your kids eating junk food because it just wasn't there, you don't have that in your house. You model running together, walking together, bicycling together, swimming together, doing things together, being physically active, being creatively alive. You don't think sickness, allergies, all of these kinds of things. Imagine that.
You know that most of the problems that people have in their life are in their mind. It's their thoughts. People worry. They worry about getting older. They worry about whether they're going to have enough money. They worry about whether their children are going to do drugs. They're worried about how they're going to make their mortgage payments. There's worry, worry, worry all the time. Now think about what that is. It is just thoughts. It's just thinking in your mind about something that is going to happen. And you know that that kind of thought can create all kinds of anguish within you. It can make your blood pressure go up. It can create an ulcer. I mean, you can actually grow an ulcer from thought, form from thought. Your blood pressure going up, your heart disease increasing. Those are the result of the way that we think, so that you can have physiological reactions to these thoughts. And when you start thinking in different ways, when you start just using thought in a way that is productive and useful for you and saying to yourself, instead of occupying my present moments with these thoughts of some disaster down the road, some horrendous thing that's going to happen, I'm not going to have those. I'm going to anticipate that it's going to work out fine. And then I'm going to start acting on that expectation, on that belief. You just expect that your plane is going to take off on time. And you expect that your children are going to be happy. and that they're going to make sensible decisions. And then you will treat them with those expectations. And you will arrive at the airport with those expectations. And even if you arrive there and your plane is late, you don't tell yourself that it shouldn't be that way. You say, well, it probably is saving my life. It's like I called a good friend of mine and I got a ticket a couple of years ago for speeding, 10 miles over a speed limit. I called him up and I was talking about it. He said, don't you understand that man saved your life? I said, what? He said, yeah, he saved your life. He said, just around the corner from there, there was an accident waiting to happen. For sure, that would have been you. And he stopped you right there. And he said, that's the way I look at it. He said, that's the way I look at it. Instead of looking at the negative in it, I say to myself, if my plane were taking off now, there might be some difficulty. It's not supposed to take off now. It's going to take off when it's supposed to. How can you argue with that? It's going to take off when it's supposed to. It's like learning how to use thought in such a way that you don't create ulcers and you don't create disasters in your mind. And before long, there are none. And even the disasters, quote, that are out there, you now begin to look for the opportunity in those. You begin to look for what's the blessing, what's the gift, what is here for me, instead of all the negativity.
Everything that happens to you is stored away. Your brain has trillions of cells. Not millions, not billions, trillions of cells. It is capable of things that are just so phenomenal as far as healing, as far as health goes, as far as success goes, and it all depends on how you see yourself. Now, you get trained as a young person not to see yourself as a very competent human being, especially you women. Most of you were trained not to think of yourselves as equal with men or better. When you were little girls, many of you were taught that in order to be athletic, that's not feminine and that's not appropriate and you don't do that. And so you have a lot of these sentences. And I ask you about these sentences that you use in your mind. The I'ms. I'm nervous. I'm shy. I'm not very good at mathematics. I'm not a good cook. I'm clumsy. You figure out the I'm. Now, every I'm that you have, a lot of that was encouraged because you weren't encouraged to take risks. And you must take risks if you want to be successful in life. You must take risks. When you're a child, I've heard parents say, don't you go near that water until you know how to swim. And I think, there's something missing in that logic there somewhere. And so you train yourself when you're young because you believe that stuff. Not that it's anybody else's fault. You believe it. You believed it. You didn't have to. Now you got to take responsibility for buying it. And if it doesn't apply anymore, sell it. And if nobody wants to buy it, then just give it away. Get rid of it. All right? And change the images. Now, what kind of images do you have? Here we are. We're going on a trip. And here's the car. And here's the trunk. Okay, now we're getting all ready and we put all the suitcases in the suitcase. I mean, clearly it says in the car manual how many suitcases this trunk holds. 5 suitcases. It says that. You got 6 suitcases sitting right there in the ground. Now, how do you visualize it? Who are you? What kind of a thinker are you? Do you know that most people are going to need help, are going to say, you can't get those suitcases in that trunk. Now, when you have that kind of a picture that it can't be done, do you know how that gets stored away in terms of the action that you take on it? You say, we're just going to have to repack them, or we're going to have to put one in the back seat, and that's it. We can't be done. There's those who say, now there's a challenge. I know it can be done. And you know there are people like that. Those suitcases are going to get in the trunk. I know it. And they start maneuvering this, and they put it over there, and if I did this, and they see it happening. What kind of visions do you have? Who are you? I'm not standing up here in front of all of you people saying that all you have to do is put a different picture in your head, and your life is going to turn around. I am saying, and get this, I am saying that you must start first with the kinds of pictures that you have. And then they will get stored away in you as reality. And when that reality gets stored away in you, you will start acting on that reality rather than on another reality. There's a word in our language, it's called disaster. Do you know what it means? The origin, the etymology of disaster. It means to dis, D-I-S, associate from the astral, A-S-T-R,
That's the origin of it. Disastral. Disassociate from the astral. The astral is the plane, the dimension that I'm calling thought. Emerson said, you become what you think about all day long. You are the sum total of your thoughts. Whatever you think, therefore it shall be. Someone said, do not be conformed to this world, but be what? Transformed of it. Thought and visualization are the same thing. It's practice in the astral plane. If you want to learn how to hit a backhand in tennis in the physical dimension that you are, the 1% of you that is physical, you go out there and you hit 1,000 a day, you hit 1,000 a day, and if you hit 1,000 backhands a day for a year, you're going to be able to hit a backhand without thinking about it. It's going to be automatic and you're going to be good at it, and that's called practice. Thoughts, visualization, are practice in the formless dimension. And the more you practice those thoughts, you will act eventually upon whatever thoughts you have. And it's why I tell people who are trying to lose weight, don't try to lose weight, because lose is a negative. Whenever you fight something, you're always weaker. Every time you fight something, you're weaker. You don't want to be a fighter of anything. You want to be a flower, if you will. You want to understand that when you're fighting something, it owns you, and you're always weaker for the result. In order to be the weight that you want to be, you have to see yourself looking the way you want to look. And you get that picture in your mind, and you store it away, and you get that picture, and you have it there. And you see yourself looking that way. And before long, you will act on that picture.
The first thing about visualization, and the key to understanding it, is that you act on the image that you have consistently. Whatever it is that you're doing, this is true for gaining wealth. If you continually convince yourself that you're poor, that you can't make any money, that this is your lot in life, that it's because of your inheritance, because of where you happen to live, or whatever it may be, that this is something that you are stuck with, then that's how you're going to start acting. You're going to act on whatever picture you have, and you'll consistently go through life expecting not to be able to overcome that. It's true of everything. That's the first part of visualization. You act on the pictures that you have. So you go to work on the pictures, all right? The second thing is that when you visualize something, what you have to understand is that everything you visualize is already here. Where else could it be? On another planet, in another solar system, in another reality system, in another dimension? It's here. If you want to sell 5 million widgets to somebody else and you've only got 100, the 5 million widgets may not be here, but who are you going to sell them to? I mean, that's basically what you're looking at. And those 5 million people are here someplace. They've got to be on this planet. We're not talking about selling them to Martians. They're here. All you have to do is tune in. You have to tune in to them, all right, and help them to have the same image that you have about them buying your widgets. That's the second thing about visualization. And the third, and I think perhaps the most important thing about understanding the power of visualization, is that when you visualize something and you want it to work for you, all you have to do is continually keep that image in your head. Don't let it go away. Don't let somebody else convince you that you can't have that image. That process of imagery, of visualization, is that it's already here. You can make it happen because you understand that your behavior comes from the pictures that you have, and that picture doesn't have to go away unless you send it away. That's the power of visualization.
You are the creator of thought, which means that in some metaphysical way, you're the creator of your life. Thought originates with each one of us. But most of us have trained ourselves to believe that whatever we think just sort of happens, and thoughts just sort of, I call it the pop-in theory, you know? They just sort of pop in, and I can't help it. I'm walking along, and they just, boop, there's a thought, and it's just there. And I can't help it, it just happened. That isn't true when you train your mind. We spend so much of our energy training ourselves in all kinds of areas. We train ourselves in business, and if we're going to get a new computer system, we go out and we spend millions of dollars in a company, and we train people how to work it, and we want to become good at golf or swimming or tennis or backgammon or anything that you can think of. We know that we got to go out and we got to practice, and we got to train ourselves. We train ourselves, and we ignore our mind, which is 99% of who we are. We just completely ignore it. Like there's no training available for our minds. And we can all do that. I've really learned how to do it myself. No one ever taught me, but I've really learned how to train my mind. I mean, anybody listening who thinks that they have a bad memory, if they want to train it, they can just order a couple of sets of tapes right from this company. They can work on training their memory, and in a matter of a week. You know, when I used to teach at the university, I taught in Berlin for a half a year. There were 70 students in the class, and I would have the first student introduce themselves and their name. Then I would have the second student introduce the person who was just introduced and himself, and then each time I would repeat it. Then I'd have the third student introduce the two that he had just introduced plus himself, and we'd do that for the whole class. That's, by the time we got to the 70th student, they had to introduce everybody in the class by name, and I would then repeat each one of them. And I just had a very simple technique for doing that. It was just like concentrated effort on making my mind remember 70 people's names in an hour and a half. Now, I wasn't doing it to waste an hour and a half. This was a class on teaching people how to identify neurotic behavior. And it's like what I wanted to do was to teach them that they could do things with their minds, just like their patients do, that they never thought of, that they never even dreamt were possible for them. 2 weeks later, 3 weeks later, they would have like 80-90% recall. And by the end of the fourth or fifth week, everybody knew everybody's name in the class. And they had all trained themselves. And most people go out there and they're introduced to somebody and they say, hello, my name is Wayne. They say, what would you say your name was? They can't remember one person's name in 1 minute. And they think that, oh, I have a poor memory. But it's because they don't train. To change the way that you process anything in your life is really so simple. And we try to make it so complicated. Now, its simplicity is what makes it so complex or so difficult for people. Its simplicity is when you say, how do you change one thought to another? The answer is, you just do it. Nobody knows how. How you go from a negative thought of something that is very unpleasant in your mind to something very beautiful and very powerful in your mind. You know, to go from an image of a suffering animal to a bouquet of roses. The way that you do that is you just do it. You just picture the roses now instead of the animal. Now what we want to do is try to come up with what are all the synapses that are created in there and what is all of the chemistry involved there. I don't know the answer to that. I'm not a chemist. I do know that if I want to change a thought, that I just have to do it. And it's just like I tell people, if you want to quit smoking, I mean, the way you do it is you stop putting cigarettes in your mouth. If you want to quit habit of nail biting, then you keep your fingers out of your mouth. If you want to change the habit of processing the world in a negative way, then you change the negative thoughts to change the way you process. And how you do it is that you simply do it. How you sustain it is through being aware of what kind of thoughts are creating that in the first place. If it's so easy, why don't people do it? The answer to that is because the payoffs for not doing it are greater than the payoffs are for doing it. If you are able to manipulate and control somebody through your anger, and you're not able to manipulate and control them through your gentleness, and manipulating and controlling people is on your agenda, then that's what you're going to do. Now, if you get that off of your agenda, or if you realize that that agenda is keeping me from relating to the people the way I would like to, and it's going to end up in another divorce or in another painful experience for me, and if you can recognize that, and sometimes you have to go through several of those before you get it, then you stop. There's a payoff for all of that. So yes, it's easier to be Christ-like. It really and truly is. It's easier to be Buddha-like. But the payoffs for that in a world where people are still trying to manipulate and control others and acquire for themselves and get an outcome isn't nearly as great. It's such a fundamental thing for the awakening soul or for the person who's discovering that magnificent universe within, that all of those emotions that you experience, the rage and the hate and the anger and the bitterness and the tension and the stress and all that emotional baggage that we carry around with us comes from our thoughts. It's like when you're in a dream and you're sound asleep and you're having a dream, and everything is in thought when you're in your dream. Perhaps you're having an angry exchange with someone in your dream and you're hitting them and you're biting them and you're punching them and you're screaming and you're scratching at them and everything. And you wake up and you look back on the dream and you realize that it was all thought. I mean, everything was thought. The character that you're in fighting with is a thought. And the scratching and the hitting, that's all thought. I mean, it's just all going on in your mind. And you look at yourself and you realize that you're breathing hard. Your blood pressure is up, and that your jaws may be clenched, and your fist may be clenched, and there's a tightness about you, and that all came from thought. And it's like an illusion. I mean, the real cause of it wasn't the person, because the person was a thought. The real cause of all of this stuff that you're experiencing in your body right now as you're awake, looking back on this dream, was just thoughts. Created it all. That your thoughts can make your blood pressure go up. Your thoughts can make your skin flush. It can give you an ulcer. It can make you cry. It can make you enraged. And it can make you a killer, your thoughts. That's within each one of us, those thoughts. So that when you discover that, and that's one of the beauties of knowing why you dream. I mean, everything that you do in that state, you're capable of doing in the awakened state, if you will. And so you look at the awakened state and you look at the things that make you angry and you realize that they're just thoughts. That he doesn't really make you angry. He can't. That you make yourself angry over your way of processing who he is or who she is. And that your sadness and your stress are really thoughts, that there's no stress out there. That there's only stressful thinking and then acting on the stressful thoughts. So you begin to see that it's like... That all of my problems, all of my difficulties, all of my emotional charging and stuff that I don't really want to defend, all comes from my thoughts, my thinking, my mind, which is where your divineness resides. And so what you do is you go to work on that. You don't go to work on your emotions. You go to work on what creates those emotions, and especially the ones that don't work for you.
Prove to yourself that you're more than just a five-sensory being. I mean, if you really want to know this about yourself and you're committed to changing it, then write down all of the things that you experience within yourself that are beyond your sense of taste and sight and hearing and smell and touch. See, what you want to do here is you want to prove to yourself that you're more than just a physical body, and it's necessary for you to believe it in order for you to get to this new alignment that is going to manifest real magic for yourself. So what you do is keep a journal for a day. Keeping a journal is a wonderful idea anyway. Keep a thought journal just for one day. Record all of your inner world there, all of the things that are beyond the physical. So you can know, not just believe, but know that you are a multisensory being. Here you're going to note any of your intuitive hunches. You have an intuition, just a slight little hunch, jot it down. You're keeping a journal of your inner world. You want to get the insight that you're much more than just a physical being. By keeping track of your actions in the physical world, you learn that you're a physical being. Okay? So that if you can keep track of your heart rate, for example, and what your pulse is, and you can keep track of how fast you run, and you can keep track of how many times you blink your eyes. There's a lot of things that you can count about your physical world. And so you don't have any doubt that you are a physical being. But by keeping track of the inner being, you get the insight that your actions are coming from something that isn't physical at all. You keep track of your thoughts. You keep track of your intuition. You keep track of your feelings. You keep track of your notions, your visualizations, the pictures that you get in your head. You write them down, just jot them down. At the end of a day, you look and you say, hey, I'm a five-sensory being, of course, but I'm also more than that.
all of this stuff here, like, I can't see that intuitive picture, but it's there. It's real. Now you're becoming a multisensory being. Another thing that you can do to become a multidimensional being is to go beyond your five senses. You exercise the power of your mind on something that you might perceive to be difficult. Visualize yourself doing something that has always been difficult for you in your life. Now, what you're trying to do here is to see that you can affect the physical world with the invisible world. So what you want to do is, let's say you're a golfer. You've had difficulty with a golf swing. Visualize yourself having a perfect golf swing, or something that may be very difficult for you to do, and maybe it's something you've never done in your adult life, and that is to go to a cocktail party and not have a drink. Powerful notion. Visualize yourself. Get a picture of yourself at a cocktail party where everyone else is having a cocktail and you just have a glass of water. Just picture that in your mind, even if you're not ready to do that yet. Another thing that might be difficult for you is to jog a mile, or to bake a cake for the first time, or something that I did recently. I haven't, you know, I've got all of these little children, and I've never been to the movies on Saturday afternoon with my children in my life. I've been to the movies on Saturday afternoon when I was a little boy. My wife and I have gone to the movies and slipped away on a Saturday afternoon when we got a babysitter. But I have never had the experience of taking my 2-year-old and my 4-year-old and my 6-year-old and my 8-year-old and my 10-year-old and putting them on my lap and getting popcorn and taking a Saturday afternoon and just being there with them. This movie came out called Hook. And I had read about it, and the kids all wanted to see it, and I was preparing to figure out a way so that they could see it. That is, I would hire my babysitter, and she would take them all, and then I would do whatever I do on Saturday afternoon, which is play tennis or meditate or write, or and I have the kids out of my life for a few hours. But this time I visualized myself doing that, and I got a picture of it on a Friday evening, and my wife and I were just lying in bed, and we were talking about it, and I said, wouldn't it be nice to just take the kids ourselves to the movies and have like a family afternoon thing? And it became, from a thought, we turned it into a reality. And we went to the movies after we had that thought. It started with a thought, and we created a wonderful, phenomenal afternoon. My little boy sat on my lap, and we played Hook, and we did all the kinds of things. And I didn't realize what a Saturday afternoon movie theater is like. I mean, it's just a lot of talking and a lot of screaming and a lot of kids running around. And it was wonderful. It was a joyous experience, all right? So picture anything in your life that perhaps you think you should be doing where you're going to prioritize your life. I've said in many of my talks that, and when I used to work with dying patients, that I never heard anyone on their deathbed ever say, I wish I'd have spent more time at the office. Always, they say, I wish I'd have done, and you know what that list is like because you've got it for yourself. I wish I would have spent more time with my family. I wish I'd have gotten the priorities of my life straightened out. I wish I would have done things that would have made me a more loving spiritual being rather than accumulating a lot of things. So you don't have to wait till you're on your deathbed to experience this. So once you get this picture of something that seems tough for you to do, jogging a mile, I mean, if you're a couch potato listening to this and you've got a gut and you've been drinking too much beer and you've been sitting around too much, or if you're a housewife who's not gotten yourself physically out of shape but you still know that jogging a mile would be a tough thing to do, just get a picture of yourself doing that, all right? Now, the picture is non-sensory vision of yourself performing this difficult task. Describe it in detail in writing or record it on tape. Get an image of this several times and see if you can create the reality from the vision. When you do this, when you accomplish this, you will have broken through five sensory to the multi-sensory level. The image, remember this, the image is beyond your senses. It is invisible to the senses. And the action that you created from this picture came from that invisible part of your humanity. Get to know this higher part of yourself that truly wants to transcend the many limits that you believe in by functioning exclusively as a five-sensory being. So here what you're doing is you're creating images and visions of things that are transcendent for you. You start with the picture and you hold the picture. And then you take that picture, which is beyond the senses, and you move it into the five senses. And you have created the molecules of your life from your thoughts. And that's how all of life is created.